Hello, my name is Chip Lane. You are listening to Total EM. This week's podcast is about 10 key reminders to avoid missing neonatal sepsis. This is another part of that like top 10 or top 5 series that we've been doing because people seem to really enjoy that. And I'm really glad that this is such a popular series, which is why I wanted to make sure to include it this time around. This may seem a little familiar to you if you have listened to all of our previous podcasts, and that's because we have talked about the evaluation of fevers in a young infant. So we're talking about 90 days or younger. That was part of the EB Medicine podcast series, the specials that we were doing with evidence-based medicine, a great resource for CME content. If that's something that you're needing, make sure to check them out. But one thing I'd like to talk about here is really talking about that neonatal stage. So the first 28, 30 days of life, however you kind of want to break that down. But within that first month of life, there are lots of risks. And when we talk about fevers in the young infant, it was more focused about the fever side and ruling out sepsis from that angle or a severe bacterial infection by other means. But in this case, what we're focusing on is neonatal sepsis. And keep in mind that we're not mentioning fever completely. Fever is not the only way that neonatal sepsis can present, which is what makes it all the more dangerous. And neonatal sepsis has a high risk of morbidity and mortality. And so we need to remember kind of these 10 key points to help better evaluate for this lurking terror. So let's talk about number one. Sepsis is divided by onset. Okay, early onset sepsis is seen within the first 72 hours from birth and considered to be bacterial transmission from the mother during the perinatal period. Sometimes you may see things talking about this extending out all the way to the first 7 days of life. But again, this is something of a little bit of debate, but 72 hours, pretty consistent across the board. Late onset sepsis is seen within the first 3 months of life and is considered to be from postnatal environmental exposure to pathogens. So what we're talking about there is basically things not directly from the mother, at least not in all cases. There is a higher incidence of late onset sepsis in premature infants. Common pathogens, there's quite a few of them. They do vary based on early or late onset sepsis. Some big ones that we want to remember with early onset sepsis is group B strep. That's why there's testing on that. Prior to delivery, the idea is to help avoid that. The other thing that we want to keep in mind that's another common one is E. coli. And then late onset sepsis, they'll still include those types of things. But we also talk about other stuff that you're going to see much less frequently in early onset sepsis, such as coagulase negative staphylococci or staph aureus. Number two, look at the vital signs. And this may seem pretty straightforward, but it is a key part because we're not just looking at fever here, but we're also looking at hypothermia and tachypnea. Respiratory rates, as we all know, often get way too estimated. And a lot of times we see 16 to 20 respiratory rate, even when we're talking about an infant, which is clearly not the case, but that's because we're used to saying that with adults and a lot of people just document it, even if they didn't properly count the respirations. You need to pay attention to the respirations in these children. Fortunately, if they're really tachypneic, it's going to be pretty obvious in a lot of cases, but you still have to look. Tachycardia, it really varies a lot by the age, and there are different ways to help track for tachycardia. But one that is hopefully going to be noticed pretty easily too is hypoxemia, because these are also concerning for sepsis. But the most common changes that we see with sepsis when it comes to vital signs are fever, hypothermia, and tachypnea. Remember, a rectal temperature is your friend at this age. Any abnormalities of these vital signs should be addressed. Number three, watch for common changes. What does that mean? Well, lethargy and new poor feeding are common early signs of sepsis. Infants with changes in their mental status, their tone, or their perfusion are also concerning and seen with relative frequency in sepsis. So again, these are easy things that we either collect with the history or a real basic physical. Other signs or symptoms make up number four. So there are a variety of other signs and symptoms that we could be looking for in neonatal sepsis that can be seen both in early and late onset sepsis. And this is a rather extensive list. So to help with that, There is a table, again, from the BMJ article that I have included that helps make it a little bit easier, just like we also have a table with the common pathogens for early and late onset sepsis. I highly encourage you to check out the table. That way you can get a better idea of what we're talking about here. And this can be quite diverse, but rashes are a big one, for example. Again, looking for changes in their neurological status, decrease in urination is another one. But these things are hopefully things that we're going to be able to assess relatively easily, not something that's very, very subtle, but it's always possible. Number five, blood culture. This, according to the BMJ article, and I don't necessarily disagree, is the most important single test that you can do. However, keep in mind that the blood culture is not going to come back right away, so we usually will need some other things done to help us identify, is this patient at a higher or lower risk of sepsis? Modern automated blood culture detection systems are 100% accurate as long as there are at least 1 to 2 viable bacterial colony forming units, or CFUs, in the sample and a sufficient volume is drawn. Now, you may be asking yourselves, okay, what exactly is that? Well, since up to 25% of infected infants can have low concentrations of bacteria with less than 4 CFUs per ml, it is recommended to get at least 1 ml of blood. The idea is, again, we're trying to catch at least 1 or 2 viable bacterial CFUs, and if we get at least 1 ml, we should be able to get 4 CFUs, and in theory, we'll be able to get the 1 to 2 that we need for the bacterial culture, thanks to the modern devices that we have. Make sure to obtain blood cultures prior to starting antibiotics. Hopefully anyone who's listening to this knows that because of all the sepsis education we get, that cultures are really important whenever possible. We want to get that, but it's really, really important when we get this where in infants, this is a big deal. And make sure you're really cleaning the area that you're going to get the blood from, so that way there's no staph epidermis, for example, which is a common contaminant in our blood cultures. In adults, we usually get 2 blood cultures. In pediatric patients, we often get 1. I understand the idea is because there's not much blood there to start with, but sometimes it may really be beneficial to get a second set of cultures, or at least be able to get cultures other ways, such as number 6, urine culture. This is not routinely obtained in the standard early onset sepsis evaluation, according to the BMJ article. However, I feel like we still get it all the time, no matter when there is neonatal sepsis, but it's definitely considered when evaluating for late onset sepsis. Number 7 talks about potential tests to perform. Okay, a CBC is a good idea, but normal WBC counts are not able to rule out sepsis. A normal CRP at 8 to 24 hours after birth and another 24 hours later may rule out sepsis, as it carries a negative predictive value of 99.7%. Just keep in mind, it's not perfect. And if we're talking about emergency medicine here, we're not getting a CRP 8 to 24 hours after birth, because hopefully that kid is still in the hospital. And if they weren't in the hospital, then they probably aren't getting that early CRP. But that 24 hours later, maybe it was an extremely early discharge. It's possible, but again, this is usually something that's being done not by the emergency medicine clinicians, and that's something that we need to keep in mind. Chest x-rays can be performed to look for pneumonia, but it's difficult to distinguish from respiratory distress syndrome or transient tachypnea of the newborn. So this is kind of one of those things that chest x-rays can be done, but oftentimes may not be as helpful as we hope. And then really beyond that, the other laboratory testing can be helpful. It's kind of case-based. I really like looking at, again, the previous podcast where we talked about the evaluation of fevers in a young infant with that EB Medicine podcast series as a way to help check that out. And then kind of think from there, okay, what other tests may or may not be beneficial. And of course, if there's ever concern, get a pediatrician on board. You know, if it's a pediatric emergency medicine physician, or if it's a pediatrician who's on call, whatever the case is, you just want to make sure to have someone who may also have some additional recommendations based on what is going on at the time. This leads us nicely to number 8, the lumbar puncture. In the BMJ article, a lumbar puncture is indicated in 4 situations. a positive blood culture, which again is going to take time, clinical course or laboratory data strongly suggesting bacterial sepsis. Okay, so if they have like a high white count or maybe they have concerning urinalysis or something else, okay, I can see that being helpful or just basically based on the patient's presentation, but this is a rather vague suggestion there. Third option is an infant that does not approve with appropriate antimicrobial therapy. This has me concerned because you're going to have a lot of people who encourage getting a lumbar puncture if you think it's at all necessary prior to starting antibiotics, just like we are going to do with a blood culture. And then the fourth is when there are clinical signs of central nervous system CNS involvement, such as lethargy, irritability, fever, or seizure. Keep in mind, irritability, inconsolable crying is usually what we're referring to there. Also, keep in mind, these recommendations have been talked about in podcast 174, which is the one about the fever in the young infant, which is something I think is worth checking out because I feel like they're a little more aggressive on their lumbar punctures, but not overly aggressive as they get older. But basically, with that podcast and with the recommendations with EB Medicine and their kind of algorithmic approach, pretty much anyone in our neonatal stage will get a lumbar puncture. Just remember, though, that that's talking about fevers, which is much more clear cut because we're already concerned about bacterial sepsis there, versus when we're talking about other kind of more vague symptoms that are still, again, concerning for sepsis. Number nine, antibiotic choice. This is something that is going to be a little bit controversial because it varies a little bit based on local bacterial prevalence, antibiotic resistance patterns, and recommended guidelines that you are going to follow. But specifically from this BMJ article, they talk about for early onset sepsis, ampicillin and gentamicin should be given. And then for late onset sepsis, vancomycin and gentamicin or ceftaxime. And this is something that, again, should be discussed with whoever is going to start managing this patient prior to starting the antibiotics, especially if we can make sure we get our cultures done first. Like I said, the blood culture is the biggest one, but I'd even be saying like, hey, you need to get the urine for the urine culture and potentially that lumbar puncture so you can get the CSF culture already going prior to starting antibiotics. Number 10, the final point. Morbidity and mortality. This is less of a teaching point as far as what we should be doing, but to emphasize the importance of this. Neonatal sepsis has a case fatality rate of 2% in term infants, 20% in premature infants, and 30% when there's concomitant meningitis. Terrible, terrible numbers. 2% is already scary enough. But to talk about 20 to 30%, depending on other risk factors of what's going on, is terrifying. In patients with group B strep, 7% of early onset sepsis cases had confirmed meningitis, and in 27% of late onset sepsis cases. This is really important to keep in mind because if you know that there has been group B strep exposure and you have someone that you're concerned about with sepsis, you really, really need to think about meningitis. And that would be, I think, another reason why to push for the lumbar puncture. Again, this is something that you may or may not have this information. And hopefully, mother was treated in advance to treat the group B strep, but that's not always with 100% certainty. Neonatal sepsis is associated with multiple forms of developmental delays. And this is all a somber reminder of why it's so important to be ever vigilant and so that we can better recognize neonatal sepsis early to provide the appropriate treatment quickly and improve outcomes. I really hope that you can take away these 10 key reminders. Like I said, this was a really solid BMJ article. I've got it linked in the show notes, so you can make sure to check it out and read it. It does talk about like some kind of case examples and whatnot. Also, make sure to check out podcast number 174 if you want to know more about basically evaluating for sepsis and looking at pediatric fevers in the young infant, you know, 90 days or less. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out. I'd love to hear your comments too. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.